Welcome to Singer Liwek's podcast series, brought to you by the professionals of Singer Liwek from various areas of expertise. Our podcast series touch upon different subjects related to growth, strategy, tax advisory services, and technical and regulatory matters.
Hello again, and thanks for joining us for part two of our three-part series where we're talking about measures your company needs to take to prepare for the impending FASB lease accounting rule changes. I'm joined by Kevin Mitchell with Saville Studley, a national corporate real estate advisory firm. In his role as corporate managing director, Kevin specializes in helping clients make good business decisions with respect to the real estate they occupy for their operations. Well, hello again, Kevin.
Hi, Rob. Great to be here.
Excellent. So let me summarize a little bit where we left off in our first podcast. That's how we talked about where the new rules will virtually bring all leases onto the balance sheet, despite the rules not taking effect until 2019 for private companies, why these same companies need to start addressing the changes right now. To summarize that discussion, Kevin, the reason companies shouldn't wait until 2019 to address these rule changes is simply because it'll be too late. Once a lease is signed, we have the ability to designate the proper way to report it, but what we missed is the opportunity to properly structure it. Is that correct?
Exactly right, Rob. Most of the leases that we would sign today are going to have a term longer than 2 years, which is going to put these leases into the purview of the new rules in 2019-2020. And so if you negotiate those leases today without an eye for how they're going to be reported in 2019-2020, it creates a significant risk of unintended consequences, both with respect to the balance sheet and financial metrics.
Perfect. So the purpose of today's discussion is to elaborate on these dynamics with specific examples that illustrate the magnitude of dollars that are at risk by not addressing these rule changes today before you sign those leases. At the close of our last discussion, you may recall that the impact can be quite substantial.
Exactly right, Rob. Depending on the way that you structure the lease, the impact on the financial metrics can be very different. The tool that's typically used today to aid with decision-making is an NPV analysis. And going forward under the new rules, that's going to be insufficient to distinguish between the different structures.
Yeah, that makes sense. I can imagine different leases with the same net present value that have very different impact on EBITDA, for example, right?
Exactly.
So what are some of the terms we're talking about that can have an adverse impact on the balance sheet but not be distinguished correctly in a net present value analysis?
Well, today I want to talk about three: tenant improvements, renewal options, and the rent schedule. And part of the reason that I selected these three is because one of the things that I want to highlight is that it's not necessarily a zero-sum game. There's going to be instances where maybe landlords will have a level of indifference between different structures, but for the tenant, there's a significant difference in outcome.
Okay, great. So tell us a little bit about different structures for tenant improvements.
So typically there's two approaches that are taken in leases with respect to tenant improvements. The first approach is a turnkey approach. And under that approach, what happens is a tenant basically puts together a space plan and presents that to the landlord. And then the landlord executes on that plan in terms of building the space out on behalf of the tenant. The alternative approach is a tenant improvement allowance, where in the lease it spells out that the landlord's going to provide a certain amount of dollars in terms of capital that will be used to build out the space. So it might be $40 per square foot, for example. And you talked a little bit earlier about the magnitude of dollars. This is a very good example of where structuring the lease can have a dramatically different impact. So if you take a 25,000 square foot lease and contemplate that there's a $40 per square foot tenant improvement allowance, that's basically $1 million. From the landlord's perspective, they're going to spend $1 million, whether it's accounted for as a tenant improvement allowance or a turnkey build out. The dollars are the same to them. So they're going to be having a level of indifference in terms of the approach. But if you're a tenant that's focused on EBITDA, you're going to very much prefer to do a tenant improvement allowance approach versus a turnkey, because when you're calculating EBITDA, you get to deduct that element of rent that's attributable to the tenant improvement allowance. Under a turnkey approach, you don't know what that dollar amount is. And so when you calculate EBITDA, you have to deduct the entire rent, which makes it, you know, it basically unnecessarily reduces EBITDA. And thinking about this again, building on the theme that you mentioned earlier, from an NPV perspective, these two approaches are presented the same, because you're basically going to make an assumption about the overall cost and then deduct the amount of dollars that are going to be provided by the landlord to offset that cost. And so from an NPV perspective, it doesn't really distinguish between these two. This term could also have a significant impact on a tenant's motivation to renew or relocate. All things being equal, the rent that a tenant pays on a renewal option should be less, and it should be significantly less, than a tenant that's relocating to a new space, because you're basically eliminating from the landlord's perspective any downtime in rent, as well as a renewing tenant oftentimes doesn't require as much of a tenant improvement because they're already in the space. However, what you can imagine is a scenario where on that relocation option, if the tenant improvement allowance is high enough, once you net out that allowance from a reporting perspective, even though it's a higher rent on an NPV basis, it could actually have a lower impact on EBITDA by the time you take from that relocation rent the element that's attributable to the tenant improvement. So that's something else that's relevant here.
Okay, well, that makes sense. So when calculating EBITDA, you can deduct the component of the rent that is attributable to the tenant improvement allowance, but an NPV analysis would not distinguish this from a turnkey approach, because for NPV purposes, both approaches are just dollars that offset the overall tenant improvement cost, correct?
Exactly right. And that can manifest itself both in an office lease as well as an industrial lease. And in another scenario, I'll use the example earlier where you have a 25,000 square foot office space and you have a $40 tenant improvement allowance. But you can also see that occur in an industrial space where maybe it's a 200,000 square foot industrial building and the landlord is delivering that building to you with 10 or 15,000 square feet of office already in it. That, again, would sort of take on a similar structure to a turnkey approach where you're not going to be able to deduct from rent those dollars that were attributed to building out that office space.
So let's move on. Let's talk a little bit about renewal options. What are the dynamics to consider here?
So this is a scenario where, depending on what the client's objectives are, you're going to have a very specific way that you want to approach renewal options. One of the risks of not having an eye for the way that leases are going to be reported under the new rules with renewal options is that you can end up inadvertently putting a renewal term on your balance sheet. And the way that that happens is the standard for reporting a renewal option is if there's a significant economic incentive to renew. And you can imagine a scenario where a real estate broker is trying to be aggressive and they go to the landlord and they say, hey, we need 90% fair market value renewal or 95% of fair market renewal option. And they think that they're doing their client a service by virtue of being aggressive on that term. But what they've actually done now is triggered a requirement on behalf of the tenant where now they have to report that renewal option on their balance sheet. So that could be a big surprise that's very detrimental to what they're trying to accomplish with their financial metrics. So that's kind of one scenario. Another scenario could be where you're doing the exact opposite, where you're trying to make sure that renewal options are included on your balance sheet for the purpose of transforming your lease from an operating lease to a capital lease. And the idea there is that under the current rules, the motivation has been to preserve treatment as an operating lease because that allows you to keep it off the balance sheet. But under the new rules, both capital leases and operating leases are going to be on the balance sheet. The difference between the two, however, is that with a capital lease, you get to deduct interest and amortization. And so again, if you're an EBITDA-focused company, that's something that's going to be very attractive to you. So one of the mechanisms that you can use to try to transform your lease from an operating lease to a capital lease is through renewal options. So just taking an example, let's say that you sign a lease in a building that's worth $10 million and the consideration of that lease is $7 million. The standard in terms of getting capital lease treatment is basically all but an insignificant element of the overall value of the building is tied up in the lease. So $10 million building, $7 million lease, that's probably not sufficient to get capital lease treatment. So what you can do, however, is if your real estate representative is savvy, they might make one of the most important terms for you to negotiate is a below 100% fair market renewal option so that you trigger that significant economic incentive to renew. And now you get to contemplate that renewal option as a part of that calculation. So if you have a $7 million lease in the original term, but now with the renewal option, now you have a $10 or $11 million lease, now you do get capital lease treatment, which is going to be very beneficial for an EBITDA-focused company because now you can deduct the interest and amortization. And just tying this back again to the theme that I mentioned earlier in terms of this not being a zero-sum game, two points. One, in the instance where you don't want to include the renewal, certainly a landlord doesn't care. He would probably prefer to give you 100% fair market value over a 90 or 95%. Certainly in that instance. And then in the instance where you're actually using renewal options to create capital lease treatment, that might be an instance where you might depending on how you engineer it, having a willingness to pay a slightly higher rental rate in exchange for getting that below market renewal option so that you get the capital lease treatment where that interest and amortization deduct more than offsets the increase that you pay in rent. And lastly, with respect to renewal options, building on the theme that you mentioned earlier, Rob, an NPV analysis is not going to distinguish between any of these options at all, because typically on an NPV analysis, you're not showing renewal options in any event.
So what I'm hearing is there is no one-size-fits-all solution here. Some instances, you'd want to structure renewal options one way, and in other situations, depending on your motivation, you'd want to structure them a different way, right?
Exactly right. Yeah, in some situations, the motivation is to try to seek that capital lease treatment. That's going to be something that occurs mostly in situations where a tenant's occupying an entire building. And then in other instances, you're going to want to make sure that you don't structure the renewal options in a way where you inadvertently put the term of the renewal on your balance sheet. One additional place where the renewal options can become relevant, and this is more of a tax consideration, but in the context of sell leaseback.
Now you're going to talk about taxes. I'm all ears.
Yeah, so these renewal options are also relevant in the context of sale leasebacks, right? And just to illustrate, sale leasebacks are treated very differently under today's rules versus the way that they'll be treated under the new rules from a tax perspective. And just to illustrate that, here's an example. Let's say that company buys a building for $10 million. They occupy it for a period of time, and they do a sale leaseback. And as a part of that sale leaseback, they sell the building for $20 million, and then they sign a 10-year lease. So there's basically $10 million of gain on the building. Under today's rules, from a tax perspective, you get to spread out that $10 million of gain over the life of the lease in the sale leaseback. So in my example, there would be $1 million of gain each year for the 10 years of the lease. Under the new rules, you have to realize all $10 million of that gain in year one. So a very, very different tax scenario. And what this does is it creates a very strong incentive to finalize a sale leaseback in advance of these rules taking effect. And the benefits are two. So if the lease that you sign as a part of a sale leaseback is an operating lease, you at least get to spread out that gain over the life of the years that occur between now and when the new rules take effect, so maybe 2 or 3 years. If you're able to secure capital lease treatment and finalize a sale leaseback in advance of the new rules, you basically preserve the treatment under the current rules. That is to say, you can spread out that gain the same way you do today over the 10 years of the lease, so only $1 million of gain per year versus $10 million in year one. So to circle that back to what I started with, the reason that that's relevant in the context of discussing renewal options is that you can use renewal options the same way that we used them earlier to transform a lease from operating lease to capital lease. In the context of a sale leaseback, you may want to do the exact same thing to get that capital lease treatment and thereby preserve the current rule treatment with your sale leaseback and get much more favorable tax treatment.
So that's a big game changer for any companies considering a sale leaseback, right? The new rules create a pretty strong incentive on the tax side to complete that transaction prior to those rules taking effect, especially if you can achieve capital lease treatment or under the new Type A treatment, right?
Exactly right, and that's something that we can help companies do.
The last lease term you mentioned earlier is the rent schedule, so let's talk about that for a minute.
So this is an example that has an application to companies that are focused on shareholder value. One of the misnomers about the new rules is that it's not really going to have an effect, because even if you put these leases on the balance sheet, you're going to have an asset that's going to be offset by the liability. And so in that sense, it's going to be, you know, kind of a net effect of zero. The problem is that over the life of a lease, the asset depreciates, and in most situations, the rental rate goes up. And so there's a gap that tends to increase over the life of the lease between the asset and the liability. If you're a shareholder equity or shareholder value focused company, what the new rules do is they basically create an incentive for you to try to flatten out your rent as much as possible. In an ideal world, from an academic sense, you'd love it if the rent went down over time to sort of match that depreciation in asset. Standing here today, I don't know if that's necessarily a realistic expectation, but at the very least, you want to try to flatten out the rate increases. In different landlords, kind of going back to the theme we talked about earlier in terms of zero-sum game, different landlords will be more or less receptive to that. There's going to be some landlords where their objective is to buy a building, ratchet up rental rates, and then sell. And those types of landlords are going to be less prone to allow you to have a flatter rental rate. But then there's other groups that we can probably think of that aren't really intending to sell their buildings anytime soon. And so a lot of times their focus is maximizing the effective rate or the average rate over the term. And we can imagine scenarios where you have the same average rate, but the schedule is very flat, or we can have a situation where it's the same effective rate and the schedule has significant increases. Again, in that instance, the landlord's going to be indifferent because their focus is the effective rate. But from the tenant's perspective, if you're focused on shareholder value, you're going to want that rent schedule to be as flat as possible.
So when I think about this situation, this is where an NPV analysis can actually point in the wrong direction, right?
Yes, and I'm glad you brought that up, because if you think about it, basically what happens in an NPV analysis, the dollars that are paid in the front end have more of an impact than the dollars that are paid on the back end. And so from an NPV perspective, it's going to look more attractive if you have a higher rent increase with lower rate to start. But that's going to point you in the exact wrong direction. Another place where this will become increasingly relevant in this real estate market, it's not necessarily something that we're seeing a lot of yet, but as the market turns, I think it's something that we'll see more of, is blend and extends. And that's basically a scenario where there's multiple years left on a lease, the real estate market has gone down, and so the rental rates that are available in today's market are significantly lower than the rents that are on the books under current leases. In that instance, there's a receptiveness sometimes on the part of landlords to do blends and extends, where they basically extend the lease in exchange for reducing the rate on an immediate basis. That's something that from an NPV perspective can be attractive because you're getting immediate reduction in your rental rate. But depending on how that's structured, there's two pitfalls with that. One is if you're a shareholder value company, that steep rental rate increase is going to be something that damages shareholder value. And secondly, part of what we're looking at from a reporting standpoint is the effective rental rate, if we're straight lining it over the life of the lease. And if that effective rate is higher than the rental rate under your existing lease, even though from an NPV perspective it looks attractive, it's actually going to be detrimental to your financial metrics.
Interesting. So are you seeing a lot of the landlords doing blend and extends these days?
Not at this point, but I think as the market kind of goes through its cycle, we're going to see landlords being more receptive to that once vacancy increases and things of that nature.
Well, thanks again for joining me, Kevin. That was a wealth of good information that I'm sure all of our listeners will put to good use very soon. But just to underscore a couple of the things you talked about, clearly waiting until 2019 is a missed opportunity to structure your lease. And even though we only talked about three terms of a lease today, there are many, many more inside of a lease that need to be looked at because their impact could be very catastrophic if not done correctly. And most importantly, those companies or owners of companies focused on EBITDA, the time to act is now. If you have any questions about this or a previous podcast, you can reach me, Rob Schlenner, at rschlener@singerlewack.com. And I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Join us for our third and final podcast on the topic, where we will be addressing the implications of the transition rules.